This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
Time again. It is Sunday Arts Magazine here on Joy 94.9. Big thank you to Andy and Alison. Very jealous of Alison heading off to New York very soon. Now, how are you today, David?
I'm well, thank you, Brendan.
We're getting there, aren't we?
Yeah, it's weather isn't all that fantastic.
No.
But, hey.
We're going to brighten the afternoon
yes,
for our listeners.
Yes, we are. And we can start with something that we both went to see last week. It was now Sunday. And we're talking about Opera Australia's Madame Butterfly.
Yes, fantastic.
What did you think?
Now, this is my first venture into an opera. So right. I didn't really have that many expectations going in, but I was blown away by the lead actress, I suppose you'd call her, or
soprano.
I thought she was just impeccable.
Yep.
But some of the constructs, like the behaviour of the audience, I was a little bit perplexed by, because we're talking about towards the end of, when the applause is supposed to happen, there are a few boos for one of the performers. Did
was
you notice
there?
That? Yes.
I didn't pick that
up.
Oh,
you didn't?
No.
For the main male actor.
Right, okay.
But I was kind of confused as to whether it was boos for his performance or for the character who does deserve a boo, essentially.
Yeah,
he's a bit of a bastard.
Yeah.
So I was a little bit perplexed as to why people... Only a few, but enough to be like, oh, okay, what's going on here? So,
but what a production.
Oh, stunning.
Beautifully done. There's a moat, and it's literally done all around the moat, and it's just... beautiful, and the costumes are absolutely magnificent.
Breathtaking.
They've done a really good job of this production. And there's three in the series this season, isn't there?
There certainly is.
And of course, coming up in very soon, we're going to be talking to somebody from what production?
Well, it's Don Giovanni.
It's
the next cab off the rank.
Yes.
So we're going to be talking with Jane from that production. Mm. Very exciting. They're a week apart, this one.
Yep.
And then we've got, there's another Don coming up as well.
Yep.
Very soon as well. So it's the trio of operas, and it's all very, very exciting.
Absolutely. But they've really excelled, I think, with this season.
Yes.
And they're really putting so much emphasis on promoting it and the publicity. There's trams running around town, there's banners on the streets, so they've obviously got the faith in what they're doing, because they are doing such a magnificent job. They really are. I'm really taking my hat off to them and can't wait for this chat about it a little bit later on. But we've just found a couple of really nice little interesting stories.
I wouldn't call them nice stories.
One of them in particular is a fantastic story. But let's start with the colour family, in the artist Cullen.
Yeah, so the late artist Adam Cullen, his images are being used.
His paintings.
His paintings have been sort of used as condom wrappers and matchstick matches and all that kind of stuff.
For the hotel.
Yeah, for the Cullen Hotel in South Yarra.
Right, so, which they didn't ask the family's permission, because he's no longer around, and they didn't ask the permission because they have the rights to use, obviously, images, but it's that age-old thing that when there's no copyright on painting, that's the problem with the art world, and they're trying to work on that now. And because I suppose they thought the hotel's called the Cullen Hotel, it's wonderful, all his artwork is through the whole hotel, and he actually painted before he died. He actually painted a whole Ned Kelly series for the hotel, which is magnificent. They're really good, but using the images without the permission of the family.
Yeah, it's something you you'd think they would sort of approach them just out of respect to see, you know, what their feelings were, but maybe they, you know, they felt like they had ownership over the image itself and could reproduce it however they wanted. Yeah. So it's a bit of a debate out there, isn't
it? Yeah, it really is. And it's been a debate that's been raging for years now, and it's good to see it rear its head again because for the artists involved. But now there's a really other lovely story about Chloe, the famous Chloe, Young and Jackson.
Yeah, so it's actually worth a fortune.
How much?
Essentially. They valued it at $5 million.
Right.
So they're actually going to sort of look after it a bit more, restore it.
Restore it, yep.
But then also put a cover on it as well worth, I think, about $20,000 to $30,000 to sort of protect it when they do put it back up.
Because it is a tourist attraction in itself, and we all know the wonderful stories about during wartime, everyone would go to Young and Jackson's across the road from Flinders Street Railway Station before they would go down to the docks to go on to board the ships, and they would have a beer in front of Chloe and wishes good luck, and when they would return from being at war, they would do a similar thing. And you know, the controversy when the painting first went up, it wasn't there to begin with. It was actually thought as being shocking, and a lot of people wouldn't go to see the painting when it was exhibited, not in a hotel, in a gallery, because they thought it was too shocking. And now, here it is for the world to see, and which we're so lucky that we've got it right in the heart of the city, and you can go and see it for nothing or have a beer in front of it and look out the windows across at Flinders Street Station. But it's so lovely that it is worth so much money now.
Yeah, but like in the story by Mark Hawthorne, it sort of goes into detail. It's not so much about its Australian history that's giving it its value, it's its French ties.
Yes.
So it's kind of tracing
as
all the way back.
As a real painting, as a true painting, not just our history here in Melbourne.
So I wonder who's actually sort of valued it, if it was someone Australian, because, you know, it might be worth more if it was to be sold to an Australian, you know, investor or something
because
like that.
Because of the history here.
Because of the history here. Yeah. So, yeah, it's I don't know, it's another nice debate to sort of to talk about in terms of how you do value a piece of art and how much of its history you take into account,
yeah.
So it's wonderful. And poor Chloe, she's had a bit of a mark on her leg, and they restored that at one stage. Yeah. So hopefully she's going to look even lovelier after the next restoration.
But Brendan, the thing that I absolutely love about art is that the history that often surrounds it, like with Chloe. I went back for a second time. I have a friend in town, and she wanted to see the Chinese exhibition. Now, we did an interview a couple of weeks ago about that by the curator, and it was great going back a second time and how much a history lesson that exhibition is, isn't it?
It's wonderful.
You've seen it as well, and it really is. You see the way of life that was obviously never going to be repeated, and it was just so ridiculously flamboyant and over the top, and how thousands of people lived in this forbidden city, and the amount of people that took to build it, and then the opulence of it all once it was built. And so therefore, art is showing a history lesson at the NGV right now with that exhibition.
And I love that, you know, something like that and something so profound you know, so much to it can actually change the course and the discourse of a city, like something like Melbourne.
Yep.
If something's, you know, an exhibition is very important, it can change how people talk about art in the city. So I think, you know, enough things like the China exhibition and even Chloe,
yep.
You know, it just adds to the fabric of Melbourne.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, let's get into movies.
Oh, shall we? Okay, well, I went and saw a few movies this week.
Yeah.
I'll start off with Ex Machina.
Right.
And now, this one is from writer-director Alex Garland. It's his first foray into directing. Now, he's written some wonderful, mostly sci-fi films. I'm not sure if you know, so 28 Days Later.
Yes, I do know that, yeah.
Now, he also wrote Never Let Me Go and the newest adaptation of Dredd, so Judge Dredd.
Yep.
And Sunshine. I'm not sure if you saw that one, but that was another film starring Cillian Murphy as well. So he's got this sort of very, you know, great history with writing this beautiful existential sci-fi, not just sort of, you know, action thriller kind of things,
right.
but something that has a little bit more depth. So this is kind of his progression into even more so profound sci-fi, and he gets to direct it. So it's right. wonderful. Now, it stars Oscar Isaac. He's great in it. He sort of plays this bit of a douchey, techie guy who's created basically an artificial intelligence being. And, well, I won't spoil anything, but there's complications along the way.
I'm sure there is.
But I thought it was beautiful film, the way it was shot.
Okay.
The acting is brilliant because you've only got sort of the three principal actors, and one of them is, you know, not supposed to be human.
Right.
She's sort of imitating humanity.
Right. And so a robot?
Kind of, right. kind of. But then, it, you know, the story sort of revolves around, you know, what is human. So it kind of harks back to something like Blade Runner, very similar right. in theme to yep. Blade Runner, you know, what is human and, you know, how far can AI go before it's it surpasses humanity, basically, and is actually smarter than us and can do more things than us.
Right.
So I loved it. I thought it was great. So
good.
Big props to that one. If you can go see it.
And what's it called again?
Ex Machina.
Uh-huh.
Now, I think it's definitely showing at Cinema Nova, but I think there's a few other places that is showing it around. A bit more of a low-key film. So it's not one of those, you know, crash-bang, big sci-fi films, but it's got a lot of thematic sort of relevance and depth to it. So right.
Sounds good.
Definitely worth a watch. Sort of torn whether to talk about this one. It's a new horror one called Unfriended. But I sort of thought I'd bring it up because it's produced by a gentleman by the name of Jason Blum, who I've mentioned before.
Yep.
He runs Blumhouse Productions,
yep.
and they focus on micro-budgeted, they're called, horror films and a lot of sort of thrillers and stuff like that. So made for $1 million or less, and they're just doing great guns. So it's currently made around $34 million in the US alone.
Wow. Well, so, that's because of who it's about, isn't it?
Kind of. It's sort of... It is sort of... I think the success revolves around the themes and, you know, it's kind of on trend. It's got social media. It's a sort of found footage film and it all takes place on computer screens. You don't leave.
Oh.
Yeah. So you're kind of okay. living through online experiences of the characters that right. are haunted by a former friend, basically.
Right.
So... Not the greatest film, but I loved what they tried to do with it. So I give it props, give it, you know, a bit of a C+ in terms of, you know, enjoyment that I got out of it.
Right.
But I think you're going to see a lot more horror films, possibly even dramas sort of based around the idea of life through social media and Facebook and all those kind of things, as opposed to real life. Now, you could probably argue that that is real life for a lot of people, but anyway. Now, we're going to talk about another film in a little bit as well. We'll get back into that. Kurt Cobain, Montage of Heck.
Yes.
Wonderful film, but we'll get onto that a little bit later in the show. And you're listening to Sunday Arts Magazine with David and Brendan.
Joy 94.9.
Lovely track that is. It's Sunday Arts Magazine here on Joy 94.9. David and Brendan with you. Now, David, that was from the album Pink Martini.
That's right. A wonderful album.
Yes.
Well, they're just an amazing band. They actually tour Australia. A lot of Australians have seen them live. And they're about a 10 or 12-piece band when they tour. And it's just this wonderful... well, our guest coming up actually has the album, says it's great for dinner parties. And as a matter of fact, join us now. Tell us your opinion on it. And somebody recommended it to you, didn't they?
Yes, I did. A colleague of mine, when I was in the chorus at Opera Australia, gave it to me for my birthday.
Right.
And I hadn't heard of them at all. And I just love it. I love every track on it. I just think I think they're magnificent.
Great. Now, who are you?
This voice.
Now that you've actually done a review for us.
My name is Jane Ead, and I'm a principal opera singer with Opera Australia.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's absolutely our pleasure. Now, we were talking about Madame Butterfly. We went to see it last week. And tomorrow night, you take over with what opera?
Don Giovanni.
Don Giovanni. And what part do you play?
I'm Elvira, which is the Don Giovanni of the title, sort of sweeps through towns in Europe, cutting a swathe amongst the young ladies. And I'm one of the young ladies that he has spent some time with and then heartlessly abandoned. Mm. And I spend the rest of the opera chasing him about.
So you actually give him a bit of a hard time.
I give him a very hard time.
Good on you.
I take it upon myself to be a bit of an avenging angel for all fallen women, and I basically turn up a lot to spoil his party and yell at him.
Right.
Now, we needed that from Min Madam Butterfly.
Yes.
Yes.
Monday.
Yes, if we'd had an Elvira in Act 1, you know, we could have saved a lot of heartache.
It broke my heart what she went through.
You know, it's
just terrible. You know, like, it really is. But how brilliant she was. It was
Hiromi is absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Now, before we get stuck into talking about the one that you're in, let's talk about you. Give us your because we asked you this before, and you went, "Oh, really? You're
gonna ask me?" I'm not sure. I'm very interesting. I've been an opera singer for about 15 years now, and I've worked my way up through every sort of level of the company. I've done everything from the schools tour, where we take an opera to primary schools and put up our own set and drive our own trucks and things like that, to the regional tour, where I, in fact, was Madame Butterfly. We took Madame Butterfly around to the regional centres of Australia, and I did that for a couple of years, and then I was in the chorus, and now I'm a principal.
Right. So you've done it all.
Done it all. Yeah. I really have.
Which would be nice in a way, because we all look at opera, you know, especially out of Europe, where it's they're superstars, aren't they? Mm. Where here in Australia, it's a little bit of a different story, isn't it?
It's a little bit different. We're very geographically isolated. So in Europe, you have a lot of people that come straight out of their training, and they can sort of hop from town to town or country to country, doing smaller roles and then bigger roles and then the lead roles, and that's their sort of training.
Yep.
We've only got one full-time company, although we've got a number of excellent state companies that are part-time, and there isn't sort of the same path for us. So very often the principals at Opera Australia work their way up through the different sections of the company. There's a lot of principals at the moment that have come through the chorus.
Right.
And it's an excellent training. There's
absolutely
no substitute for doing it.
Yeah.
So you really do learn your craft on the job.
Tell us, where did the interest come from as a young girl?
My mother had an extensive record collection, including a 4-disc set of Joan Sutherland. And, you know, you just can't hear that woman sing without thinking she's incredible.
Yep.
And actually...
Did you ever meet her, by the way?
I did.
Oh, wow.
I was in the extra chorus of Iolanthe in Sydney.
Yeah.
It was my first extra chorus gig with the company, and I ran into her in a hallway, and I was dressed as a fairy with sparkly gold boots and wings, and I couldn't breathe for a second because I'd seen her on stage but never met her. And she said, "Oh, look at you, what a lovely fairy. They wouldn't let me be a fairy."
Oh, how gorgeous
I
was
know.
That?
And I still couldn't breathe. I think I stammered something and she sort of floated off in the other direction. I was like, "That was Joan Sutherland."
Sorry, I interrupted.
You know, she was a massive inspiration. And then pretty much every opera singer of my generation in Australia was very much struck by the Baz Luhrmann production of Bohème in the early 90s. And... if you ask any of us, you know, what made you want to be an opera singer, we'll all say the Baz Luhrmann poem.
Wow.
It was a massive influence.
Yeah.
Everyone I can think of says that poem.
Why? Because of the production was so grand?
I think the production was so... it's hard to sort of say, but it was so real. It was so human. It was so... it was a very clever update, taking it to the 50s. I was a teenager when I saw it, and it sort of spoke to teenagers. And the performances were excellent. The production was beautiful. It was very romantic. It's an excellent opera. It's one of the best operas to see if you've never seen an opera before, and it's one of the ones that will catch you. But there was just some magic about that production that it just really went straight to the heart.
Yeah. So 15 years with Opera Australia. You've done it all. How well is the company, because obviously you're very much part of this company after 15 years. Is it growing? Is opera becoming more popular? And what we were talking about before is how well you've publicised this this season with the three operas that you're doing down here.
Yeah, I think the publicising of it is becoming more and more important. it's not, it's one of the sort of the classical traditions that not as many people are encountering it in their education or from their parents or as perhaps used to happen. And opera itself is eternal. If you go along to an opera and somebody is singing at you live, unamplified, and the orchestra is playing and the sound goes straight into your bones, you know, the experience of opera is eternal. But selling the idea that opera is something that you might want to go and see sort of goes in and out of fashion. And at the moment, main stage opera, the sort of the seasons of opera that we do in the Opera House or here in the Arts Centre, have not been as much in fashion. And so the company has expanded into other events. We do an outdoor opera on the harbour in Sydney.
Which was just my sister from Adelaide went up with a group of women to see it.
Yeah, it's my brother and husband were both in that one. And it's a spectacle that you have to, I mean, it has to be seen to be believed. It's unbelievable.
So for people who aren't aware, you're sitting virtually down in front of Macquarie's chair.
Yes.
Looking over the water, so the stage is actually on the water.
Yes.
And you're looking at the Opera House
yes,
and Harbour Bridge.
Actually had to sink pylons down into the bed of Sydney Harbour to build this floating stage, and it's the most wonderful experience because you sit there and you watch the sun go down over the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House, which in itself is wonderful. And by the time the opera starts, you're already having a fabulous time. They always theme the
food.
And the bars and things, and so it's just a hell of a night, really.
Mm.
So we're sort of expanding into other projects alongside the main stage. The main stage will always be our bread and butter, but we're sort of expanding into projects that might have some pizzazz that might catch people's attention and think, oh, you know, I've never tried opera, but I'll give it a go.
Mm. Fantastic, Brendan, isn't it? And the journey that she's been on is unbelievable. We're coming back to talk about so much to ask you. So get ready, tighten that seatbelt. You're on Joy 94.9. Joy.
It's Sunday Arts Magazine here on Joy 94.9. It's David and Brendan with you. Getting excited for Radiothon that's coming up very soon.
Absolutely.
Very, very excited. We'll have to do something very special.
Yeah, you can win a car.
We'll do.
And then Friday drive, ring up and tell the person that they've won a car.
Oh, but that show's pretty terrible.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Best show in town. After this.
Now, the lovely Jane Ead has stuck around, having a fabulous chat already, but we want to get stuck into Don Giovanni a bit more, you know, deeply. So give us another little overview of what people can expect on the night.
Because this opera is Mozart, which his music is always beautiful and light and happy, but I believe it's going to be a bit of a darker side.
Yeah, this is Mozart at probably his darkest, I think.
Right.
Certainly the production is very dark. It's a David McVicar production. It was done specially for us. And it is a dark, nasty fun, actually. The set is phenomenal. It's one of the biggest sets I've ever seen at Opera Australia, and it's full of detail. There's graves, there's skulls and crossbones, there's huge stairs and architecture, and it's really something. And yeah, the work itself, Don Giovanni, is quite a dark work. It's based on the serial seducer Don Juan, and he basically goes through Europe seducing women and keeping a record of it, trailed by his faithful manservant Leporello, who is sort of exasperated with his master's antics. And it's a day in the life of Don Giovanni, and the day doesn't go so well for him, I've got to say.
Because of you.
Well,
or your character.
Because of me, because of a few different things. For a serial seducer, he has a very bad day. But he tries his luck with three different women, and it comes unstuck in three different ways. But I play the character of Donna Elvira, and she is a lady that he has seduced previously and abandoned. And I now follow him around the country, berating him whenever I see him and trying to save other women from him. But really, I mean, I sort of play the avenging angel, but I'm also still hopelessly in love with him. So from my point of view, I spend the whole night torn between wanting to give him hell and wanting to save him from hell. And yeah, he comes to a bit of a sticky end.
What's it like when you're part of a big production like this? And as you said, the sets are beautiful and the costumes.
Costumes are gorgeous. They're all various shades of black and grey, and
yep,
it's a very monochrome look, but they're very sumptuous. They have all sorts of beautiful lace and braid and a bit of bling.
It's because gorgeous. That's the wonderful thing about opera is the costumes usually are quite spectacular.
They're unbelievable, and they're such works of art.
Yeah.
And they have to be made to last 20 years for a good production. So the work and the fabrics and the detail that goes into them, they're just... You know, you could put them on dummies in a museum and they're just amazing.
Because they quite often are, aren't they?
Yep.
Yeah, here it's...
Yeah, they do have displays and they're fascinating. And I find the wardrobe manufacturing and fitting area of Opera Australia, I find that a fascinating place to just wander through because the work and the art that goes into it all is really incredible.
And it's also a case of that you can breathe properly and you can move. And so it has to take in all those elements as well as looking right.
This was my show where breathing suddenly became an issue because the period corset did not let me breathe. My character has a habit of throwing herself down on the stairs and then singing really complicated pieces of music. And I had to have a conversation with the wardrobe supervisor where I said, I cannot breathe in this corset. It would be different if I was standing up or sitting on a chair, but, you know, I'm crouched down on these stairs and I cannot breathe. And so we had to find a particular corset that I could wear that allowed me to do everything, all the running and singing and breathing that I need to do. And that was, it's fantastic. I want it forever. but, you know, those are the sort of things that you sometimes have to have a chat about.
Yep. Now, just on that, as you said, the set's huge and the costumes... The cost of putting on opera must be astronomical.
Yeah, it is. It's mammoth. There are so many people involved, for a start. You'll have, even for a small opera, you'll have 50 in the pit, sometimes 100 in the pit in the orchestra. You'll have another sort of 50 people on stage between the chorus and the principals. There's usually some actors. Then you'll have another 20 or 30 mechanists behind stage. For the Don Giovanni set, they are literally pushing walls in and out. They'll have two people to every wall. So you've got stage managers, you've got the army of dressers and people, you know, backstage. There are hundreds of people involved in putting on one production and that doesn't even include the costs of the sets or the costumes or our wages. So
and travelling and
travelling to, you know, Opera Australia likes to travel as much as they can to sort of bring opera to as many people as they can. We feel the responsibility of being the national company that we should get as many people to be able to see an opera. The costs are just mammoth, and it is we do get a lot of subsidy, but we're very box office reliant, and it's a constant worry for the company.
Well, congratulations on what you're doing and the sheer fact of, you know, the 15-year apprenticeship in a way,
yes,
isn't it?
I know.
I've never thought of it in that respect before. And is there many people like you that have been involved that long?
Yes, there are quite a few. Quite a few of the current principals have come up through Schools Tour and Chorus. There are a number of people, certainly in the backstage areas, in the mechs and things. You know, we have a 20-year wall in Sydney where we hang the photos of people that have been there 20 years. And there are hundreds of people working for the company that have been there a significant amount of time. It gets in your blood, you know, you get to the point where you just can't really think of doing anything else.
But you actually mentioned, and I'm glad we've got a little bit of time to bring it up, your brother?
My brother, yes, he's also an opera singer.
Wow.
Yes, there was a program some years ago on the ABC called Opportunity Oz, where they were looking for a talent quest for an opera singer, and he actually won that. And so he's been working for Opera Australia ever since. So he's been in about 10 years now, actually.
Okay.
And we don't get cast in the same shows very often because we have quite different voices, but when we do, it's a complete treat because my husband is in the chorus, and so we like nothing. Better than to just the three of us hang out in the green room.
Fantastic. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming in. Now, you're open tomorrow night.
We open tomorrow night. It should be a wild ride. The show's in very good shape. The cast is phenomenal. A lot of the cast that are in this Don Giovanni have done their parts several times before, and their craft and their detail just has to be seen to be believed. Teddy and Taryn and, they're just unbelievable. So it's a great show, great cast. You'll have a great night.
And it is running until May 30. So that's a decent run, isn't it?
Eight shows.
It's going to be going to be quite taxing.
Yeah, I will have clocked up quite a few kilometres. You'll see me running around the stage. I will have, if I had a Fitbit, it'd be into overdrive by the end of May.
Well, thank you so much for coming in on the eve of opening here in Melbourne. And, of course, you're playing the Arts Centre, yes, which is a spectacular stage as well. It's a very large
stage. It's our favourite stage.
Oh, great. And of course, if you want bookings, you just go to Arts Centre.
Arts Centre or Opera Australia.
Right. Thanks again for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
You're on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 in Melbourne. Joy.org.au for the world.
Joy 94.9. It is Sunday Arts Magazine on this Sunday afternoon. A bit gloomy outside, but we're trying to keep it nice and bright inside. And yes, David, you're definitely helping with that.
Oh, Brendan, so are you with your brand new haircut.
Oh, thank you, David.
You're looking very handsome.
Unfortunately, no one can see me today, but just take our word for it.
Yeah.
It's looking nice. Now, we've gone from one fantastic interview to another one.
Well,
straight away.
We'll wait and see.
I have a good feeling about this, David. Andre Schiller-Chan and Joseph Green, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Now, you're two very creative people, and we want to sort of get into your background. We'll get into what you guys have collaborated on in a little while. But we'll start with you, Andre. What's your background in the arts?
Well, I started off with documentary filmmaking, and then I just created a very big network at 16th Street with a lot of theatre actors. And then I saw the Royal Shakespeare Company do King Lear and Anton Chekhov's The Seagull, and then that was it, theatre. That was where I wanted to go with theatre. And then I had already the network, so that's just how it started. I just got my foot into the door that way, just by creating a big network.
Right. And what made you start this company?
Well, I needed to find a way to raise a voice for prisoner rehabilitation initiatives and also wrongful convictions. And the cause of wrongful convictions is ignorance and tunnel vision. The best way to alleviate that problem is by understanding that as humans, we're all one person. And the best way to do that is by film, it's by telling stories, it's by theatre, because when an actor speaks to an audience, it's like speaking to one person. And I wanted that unity to cultivate, I suppose, to oppress the tunnel vision and the ignorance that creates those wrongful convictions.
And now, so you are the artistic director, producer of Soul 3 company. Now, can you tell us about the growth of the company and what you've been able to produce up to this date?
Yeah, well, I started the company. The Soul 3 is named actually after David McCallum III, who was wrongfully convicted for 29 years, and he was a best friend of mine. So I started the company for him. And then my first play was a play called Cherry Smoke, and that was just to solidify the company. And then The Exonerated was something that I created firsthand with the Soul 3 company that I was just leading up to. So this really, The Exonerated is something that I had it at the get-go of the creation of the company, and we're doing it. We're now giving him a voice.
Now, that's where Joseph comes in. Now, let's get you talking. So how far along in the process did you come into this?
Well, I first spoke to Andre about it last year, but we actually met a few years ago, and at that first encounter, Andre spoke to me about Ruben Hurricane, and we both had an interest in him, and so we bonded over our shared passion for that. And I was so inspired by Andre's proactiveness in reaching out to Ruben and then subsequently working with these other prisoners. And that was the beginning of our relationship. And then, he wrote to me last year and said, I'm doing this play. Would you like to audition? And then here we are.
The rest is history. So tell us about this play. What's it called?
It's called The Exonerated.
Which means
that a person is taken out of jail who's been wrongfully put there due to new DNA evidence that has been uncovered, and they're released because of that.
Right. And with what's been just going on at present in Bali, it's a very topical play right now, isn't it?
Untimely, so.
Yes.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit more about the play.
Well, as you said, it does raise issues that, because of the Bali 9 executions, it really does raise issues about capital punishment and what's flawed with the justice system and why death row, there's always a chance for error. So the play talks about that. But really, half of the 50% of the play talks about with their time on the outside and how they're still dealing with problems. But it's also, it's a story of light and dark, because when you go through something like that, you really have to find the light within yourself. Otherwise, you're going to just fall into a well and never get out.
Yeah.
So the play the play has a lot of humour and a lot of lightness to it and a lot of laughter, and that's the only way you can deal with things when you go through something like that.
Right. And following a certain amount of people.
Yeah, six. Sorry, I should actually say that the Exonerated itself is taken from real manuscripts and real interviews with these six characters that you'll meet, and everything that is said is actually what they've said in the interview. So that, right. it's just basically what's called a docudrama. Everything is taken from real life interviews and events.
So, Joseph, what's it like playing one of these people that have obviously, you know, been quite traumatic but now feeling relieved? It must have been a lot of weight on your shoulders.
Yeah, I think, as Andre said, in any time you encounter a great weight of sadness or shame, you want to fight for the light or surrender to the imposition of whatever's weighing you down. And Andre's been very great in allowing us to explore the playfulness of it and finding the joy and really touching both ends of the spectrum. And I guess way of dealing with it, I was probably going to see a show at the Comedy Festival every single night during the festival after rehearsals, just to
lighten the load for yourself.
Yeah, just to sort of, you know, balance my emotional pH levels.
Yeah. So it really did get to you. It really moved you a lot. And apart from the role that you're playing, the other roles around you as well.
Definitely. I think stories and characters and people, whether you're an actor or a storyteller, just a human being, they come to us at different times in our lives to invite some lesson of some sort. And what Gary is going through, what I have been through in my life, it's not obviously an exact thing, but there are always links that you can find yourself in the other character.
Yeah.
And do you think it was easier to connect to because they were real stories?
Yeah, I think it makes it more of a privilege, and you feel more responsible to really do it justice, knowing that they're living people and have really gone through this, and that there's a lot of, you know, first-hand material to engage with and use.
Yeah, it kind of helps to know Ruben. I mean, like, I've been friends with Ruben for a long time. You know, sadly, he's passed away, and also David. So you can see in their eyes, you can see their past, but you can also see how they act right now in dealing with it. So basically, the spirit of the show is David McCallum and Ruben Hurricane Carter, and that's how I've just kind of transmuted their spirit into the play.
Okay, well, look, talking about that, Bob Dylan, who was a big supporter back in the day, wrote this amazing song called Hurricane. We'll just have a listen to it now. You're on Joy 94.9.
The man the authorities came to blame for something that he never done. Put in a prison cell for one time, he could have been the champion of the world. And he stopped. One of us had better call up the cops. And so Patty calls the cops, and they arrive on the scene with their red lights flashing in a hockey jersey night. Cops pull him over to the side of the road, just like the time before and time before that. In Patterson, that's just the way things go. If you're black, you might as well not show up on the
unfortunately, we're going to have to pull that down, even though it's a beautiful version of the song that
great
he wrote.
Live version.
There you go. It's a great story that you guys are telling, which obviously Dylan was telling in that instance as well about Hurricane. Mm-hmm. And I think it's wonderful what you're doing. Congratulations. It's powerful stuff.
Thank you very much.
So, Brendan, give us the information about how you can see the play.
Well, yeah, kicking off on the 20th of May, but you guys are running till the 7th of June. That's a pretty good run.
3 weeks.
Yeah. So, Chapel Off Chapel in the Loft in Paran. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, the venue, like how that actually, you know, dictates how you tell the story?
Oh, okay. Well, as I said, I took Ruben's spirit into this play, and I always left... When I left Ruben's house, it kind of imprinted his home, not just a house. It was a real home to him. So that's why I thought the loft would be a very intimate space to invite you into these people's living rooms, because when you walk into one of these exonerated people's rooms, it means so much more than when we walk into a house. Just walking down the street to them is a privilege. Just putting on shoes is a privilege. And I wanted to transmute that onto the stage here, and I thought the loft was the best intimate place to do that.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today, and thanks for the play. Can't wait to see it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, okay. Head to chapeloffchapel.com.au for tickets.
You're on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
It is Sunday Arts Magazine. It is getting to the tail end of it. David, it's been a great show already, though.
Yeah, very powerful both. Oh. You know, opera, which is so powerful. And what a great person she was. 15 years with the company. She's literally done a true apprenticeship coming through the opera company.
Yeah.
And the play, powerful stuff.
Yeah, The Exonerated.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be amazing. Yeah. Now, before we go, I want to talk about... I went and saw the Kurt Cobain documentary as well. A montage of Heck. So it's sort of a warts and all documentary detailing sort of his life as a child and growing up and even dealing with his drug addiction. And but the main interesting point about the film, it was produced by his daughter, Frances Bean Cobain. And so it doesn't gloss over any of the sort of more sordid details, and it would have been tough for her to go through, but maybe something very cathartic as well.
Right. Well, see, she was a baby when he died, so she wouldn't have remembered, of course. Her mother would have been telling her stories about, and the mother's a character in herself. But she's obviously come out through the end of it as an adult and has produced this, because she'd be a very wealthy girl.
She would be, yeah. So that would have been tough. But, you know, they had approval of the family, and Courtney Love was involved as well, and, you know, former members of the band as well. So, yeah, it was
so
a great...
So it's not a doco, it's actually a film?
Oh, it's a mixture. Right, it is a documentary, but there's animation in it with his vocals and storytelling and stuff like that. So it's one of those kind of new age documentaries where they sort of blur the lines between narrative and, you know, strict documentary, which I kind of love. It just gives a different dimension to the story, but I thought it did his story justice, you know what I mean? And obviously it ends in tragedy, but that's not sort of lamented on that much. It sort of talks about his influence in life and
the influence of him as a recording artist.
Yeah.
He was that generation's voice, the music voice.
He was the voice of the 90s for the disaffected, But, great film. If you can, go see it.
Okay.
Get out there. Now, stick around. We're going to have Bassam with the news here on Joy 94.9.
And thank you, Brendan, for being part of the show today.
Thanks, David. See you in 2 weeks' time.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.